You're listening to Interviews with Adam. I am your host, Adam Miller, and we are joined today by Todd Nettleton, who is the director of Voice of the Martyrs, a ministry that we have had here on the broadcast many times. And we want to get an update as to what is happening around the world. And I'm great. It's great to have you with us, Todd. It's always great to have you give us some information as to the persecuted church around the world. So thanks for being on our program again.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me. Yeah.
Our theme for this week has been to talk about John chapter 4 and this this illustration or this story between Jesus and the woman at the well. And Jesus explains to his disciples, the fields are widened to harvest. And this has become a theme, especially when we see great things happening around the world. And you just got back from Iraq, which you've got a report from, I think is really interesting for our listeners to hear about, because this is an area where, well, we don't think of much is going to happen for the church because of all the persecution and the Muslim the Muslim state, and then as well as the Islamic state that's there to persecute Christians. But tell us a little bit about your experience there.
Well, as you say, you know, we watch the news and we see the Islamic state advancing, we see the violence, we see horrible things, and it's hard to imagine, you know, anything good coming out of that. But one of the pastors that we met with while I was in northern Iraq, he used the illustration of a net and fish, and he said the Islamic State is driving Muslims toward the gospel. Muslims are looking at what the Islamic State is doing. They know that that is mirroring the life of Muhammad. They know that the Islamic State is backed by what the Quran says, and they look at that and they say, I don't want to be that. That doesn't represent me. What else is out there? And so Christians are actively witnessing. They're reaching out. They're providing aid. They're providing help. And it's turning into an open door. And Muslims are so open to the gospel message. We just heard story after story after story of Muslims being open to the gospel. And actually, one of the days we were there, we went to a baptism service and saw some Muslim background believers being baptized, which in that culture, that's sort of the point of no return. You know, once you're baptized, you're an apostate. The Quran says apostates should be killed. And so it was a very serious commitment for them. We were told before we went, leave your cameras at home. Don't pull out your phones. Don't act like you're taking pictures. That's going to freak everyone out. But there was so much joy among these new Christians being baptized. I remember one of the young ladies who was baptized, she sang a song for the people there. And the only comparison I can make is a bride on her wedding day. She just radiated the joy of the Lord and the excitement of walking with Him. So that was one of the really cool, and like I say, that they weren't alone. We heard so many stories of how open Muslims are to the gospel right now in the Middle East.
It's interesting because we hear so much negative news and reports on what's happening, or especially there in northern Iraq, but that is where you're seeing the gospel flourish. There seems to be a connection, and for somebody who has spent his ministry working with the persecuted church, you can probably give our listeners a little bit of an insight of that connection between where there's persecution, there's also the assurance of the gospel that flourishes under the guise or under the empowerment of the Holy Spirit.
That's so true, and there's several examples of the way the gospel spreads in those situations. But one of them is simply the love of Christ. One of the pastors that we talked to, his church is reaching out, and they have numerous, literally dozens of Muslim families that they're helping and supporting, providing a place to stay, providing food for. And he said, one of the Muslims talked to him about this. You know, he's being helped by this church, and he said, you know, Pastor, if this was reversed, if you were displaced from your home and you came and tried to stay in my city, I wouldn't help you at all. In fact, I might even kill you. So why are you doing this? And this pastor was like, you know, what an incredible open door. Well, let me tell you why. It's because I know the love of Christ. I know Jesus. Jesus told us to help those who persecute us, not kill them, but help them and pray for them and love them. And that, you know, that story is being repeated again and again. So that's one side, is just the willingness to help. The other side is the forgiveness. And there is no human explanation when you are, you know, your house is burned down, maybe a member of your family is killed or kidnapped, and you say, I forgive you for doing that. That, in the human mind, in the human realm, that doesn't even make sense. That doesn't even compute. The only way it makes sense is through the reality of Jesus Christ, the fact that Christ first loved us and forgave us, therefore we can forgive those who are persecuting us. That is an undeniable demonstration of the truth of the gospel of Jesus Christ. And Muslims look on that, they see that, and they know there's no human way to explain that. Jesus must be real.
And you've got some new projects that you're going to be launching with Voice of the Martyrs, and you're doing this particularly in northern Iraq. Tell us a little bit about what Voice of the Martyrs is doing to help those Christians that are really still vulnerable to the persecution of not only their Muslim neighbors, but also ISIS and all the other insurgents there.
Well, there are several ways that we are helping, and in fact, since the fall of Mosul in 2014, in the sort of the midpoint of 2014, Voice of the Martyrs has spent over $5 million helping Christians in the Middle East who were displaced by the Islamic State. We went on this trip last month, and the most significant part of our purpose for going was to help launch a program we're calling Family Med Packs. And what it is it will launch April 1st. We were over there kind of as the sort of making the way, exploring, okay, what's this going to look like? How's this going to be? The program will launch April 1st. You will send Voice of the Martyr $7. We will send you a plastic bag, a sealable plastic bag, along with a list of items that can go in that. You fill it up and send it back to us, and then we're delivering these in the Middle East. Right now, that's our primary focus. Eventually, these will spread literally around the world. But what it is basically kind of a first aid kit. You know, if ISIS comes and paints that Arabic noon letter on your home and says, you have 24 hours to flee, you typically don't go to your medicine cabinet and pack up all of your, you know, your medicines and your Band-Aids and all those kind of things. And many of the Christians who fled from ISIS, they were robbed of everything they were carrying. So even if they had packed it up, they would have lost it. So this is just a basic kind of first aid kit. It's got some Band-Aids, it's got some gauze, it's got some washcloths, just some very basic things for these Christians, many of whom left everything behind. Some of them are living in tents. Some of them are completely displaced. They have nothing. Most of them don't have jobs. They don't have a way of supporting themselves. So this is just a way to provide for those medical needs. And as well, our staff in the field is using these as a doorway for encouragement, a doorway for sharing the gospel. We know that some Christians are going to receive these med packs, and they're going to share them with Muslims and say, hey, look what Christians in the United States sent for me. I want to share some of this with you. So it's an open door to share the gospel as well.
Give us a little bit of an insight as to just the vast amount of numbers we're talking about of people that have been displaced. Not only the Christians who we're talking about now in the persecuted church that are being thrown out of their homes, but there's a lot of other people that are being displaced, and this is an opportunity for Voice of the Martyrs to be there on the front line and even share the gospel with them as well. So just give us a glimpse into sort of the numbers of people because of what's been taking place in northern Iraq that have been displaced and moved into these caravans.
Well, we're talking about tens of thousands of people in northern Iraq. We're also talking, you know, thousands displaced in Syria as well. In the region, I think it's somewhere over 1.2 million people have been displaced by ISIS. And as you mentioned, and I'm glad you brought this out, this is not just Christians. These are Yazidis, which is a minority religious group there. These are Shia Muslims, who ISIS is Sunni, so they say the Shias are apostates and they persecute them. But these are also Sunni Muslims who aren't as radical as ISIS. You know, one of the pastors we talked to talked about a man who came to their church for help. He was a Sunni Muslim living in Mosul. He was a devout Muslim. His wife was fully veiled. She was fully covered. He was a very devout Muslim. But when the ISIS took over, he looked at them and said, nope, this is not going to work. I'm not going to live like they want me to live. And so he left. He left behind a business, left behind a good job. So all of those groups are displaced, and many of them are living in camps. In fact, most of the Christians now are out of tents into more permanent housing, but there are thousands and thousands of Yazidis and Shias and Sunnis who are still in tents. One of the projects we visited while I was there, and it was one of the really cool things that we saw, was a bakery. And it's a cool partnership project because there's an Arabic-speaking church in London that bought a commercial oven for this bakery. Voice of the Martyrs is providing the flour for the bakery, so they have flour to make into bread and cook. But this is a bakery that is selling bread into several different camps, a Yazidi camp, a Shia camp, a Sunni camp, and a Christian camp. So it gives a job because these Christians are baking this bread and they're selling it for a small fee into these camps. But more importantly, it gives them an entry point to the camps because when they go, they sit down with people and say, hey, what's your name? Tell me about your family. Tell me where you're from. And with the ultimate hope that they want to share the gospel with those families. So it's a jobs program. It's a bread program because it gives bread to people who are hungry, and it's a living bread program. It gives the gospel. It gives an open door for Christians to share the gospel. Like I say, that was one of the projects we visited that excited me personally the most because it just crossed over all those lines and was help, it was food, and it was a chance to share the gospel. And the Christians there are sharing the gospel. They are seeing this as an opportunity to share the gospel. We just had some staff members return from Lebanon, and they were meeting with Syrian refugees, people who had left Syria. And one of the camps they went to is a camp that has several widows from al-Nusra fighters. Al-Nusra is one of the radical Sunni groups in Syria. And these widows, in theory, they should be sort of esteemed people within the camp because their husbands died as martyrs for the Islamic cause in Syria. Everyone should look up to them. Everyone should take care of them. But nobody was. And some Christian people came into the camp. They started providing help and fellowship for these widows. And they said some of the widows were talking about that. You know, our husbands were martyrs for the cause, and yet it's not the Muslims who are coming to help us. It's Christians. Why are you doing this? You know, why are you helping us out like this? And so all over the Middle East, Christians are seeing these displaced people as, hey, there are people who need help, and we want to reach out to them in the name of Jesus, but it's also an open door because they're seeking other faiths. They're seeking other ideas because they've been disappointed in Islam.
You were there in northern Iraq just under 2 years ago. Tell us a little bit about the progress that you've seen over the span of 2 years from when the Christians were first displaced, and give us a positive, because often we're so inundated with the negatives of what's taking place there. Give us a little bit of a positive insight of what you've seen happen.
Well, that was one of the things about my trip in January, was just to see the difference. I had been there in September after Mosul fell in July. When I was there in 2014, almost all of the Christians were in tent camps or they were in unfinished buildings. The city of Erbil, where we were, basically every nook and cranny had displaced people staying in it. If you had a building that had a roof over it but it didn't have walls yet, well, that's great. People would move in there and sleep. One of the schools, the government had said, you know, we're going to give this school, and so people were living in the school. Now, here we are, you know, 14, 17 months later, almost all of the Christians are out of tents into what they call caravans, which is kind of a portable housing unit. Think of like a trailer house here in the United States. So they're in more permanent housing. They are more situated in terms of their, you know, food is not, they don't wonder where their next meal is coming from like they did at that time. There is still great need. One of the challenges is jobs. You know, when you think about a city and it's heavily involved in the oil industry and world oil prices have dropped, so the economy in northern Iraq has dropped, and then you bring in, you know, 200,000 people who need jobs. Well, you know, obviously that's a crisis. So there is still great need, but it was certainly different and more advanced, more established than it was the last time I was there.
Yeah, when you were there 2 years ago, it was really more of a life-sustaining endeavor because there was so much threat and they were under such persecution. Now your efforts have changed to be more long-term. What are the things that Voice of the Martyrs can do to help them and those long-term goals of getting them settled in and getting them new housing, new jobs? What are the things that our listeners can be involved in, more than just prayer, because we want to encourage them to pray? But to get behind what you guys are doing there to help the Christians who have been displaced.
Well, there's several things that we're doing, and I mentioned the family med packs. That's a big part of a push that we're launching this April. The long-term needs, we are working with through local churches and local Christians there. So what we do is we come alongside those Christians and say, okay, how can we help? One of the challenges is education. And so one of the things we've done in Jordan is we actually started an elementary school or sponsored the starting of an elementary school. And that may be something that we look at in Iraq as well. I know one of the churches that we are working alongside is starting a theological training program because so many people are coming to Christ. There's a need for leaders and pastors. And so they are training up Christians to take on leadership positions. The housing needs are obviously very significant. Some of that has been solved. You know, when we talk about being in a caravan or in a portable housing, at some point you would like to be in something a little more permanent than that. So one of the challenges is to know how to help. And many of these Christians want to get out of Iraq. They want to get out of the Middle East. They see no future there. So one of the key roles that we play when we go on a trip like this is simply encouragement, saying, you know, you're not alone in this suffering. There are Christians around the world who are praying for you. They remember you. They want to help you. And in just encouraging the believers there not to grow weary, because you think about, you know, being displaced from your home, you think about being unemployed, and it would be very easy to grow weary and think, you know what, I've got to leave, I've got to get out of here.
You've got a new book coming out through Voice of the Martyrs. Why don't you take some time to tell our listeners a little bit about that, and it'll be launching here soon, so why don't you tell our listeners about this new book inspiring stories of Christians facing Islamic extremists?
The book is called I Am In, and if you think about the letter N, we're really referring to that Arabic letter N, or noon, that was painted on the homes of Christians by the Islamic State. That meant, we are claiming this home for the Islamic State. You no longer can live here. You're out of here. And so that's what happened in Mosul. That's what IS has done around the Middle East and Syria. This book looks at Christians who are living and serving the Lord in the face of Islamic extremism. And what we do in the book is we share these stories under six themes, six things that we see among these believers. The six themes are sacrifice, courage, joy, perseverance, forgiveness, and faithfulness. And so we share stories from Christians, and some of these come from the Middle East, many of them do, but there are other places where Christians are facing Islamic extremism. I think of Al-Shabaab in Somalia, I think of Boko Haram in Nigeria, other places in the world. And so this book shares stories, and like we mentioned earlier, you know, you watch the news and you think, oh, there is nothing but bad news coming out of these parts of the world. The I Am In book, which releases on March the 1st, it's available for pre-order at several retailers now. This tells you it's not just bad news. There's good news. There are brothers and sisters who are faithfully serving the Lord right in the face of those Islamic extremists, right in the face of the people who would persecute them, even kill them. They are remaining faithful, and they're serving the Lord in those circumstances.
As we look at some of these stories, and I know that this is a large part of your ministry, you're about informing the church about what is taking place around the world, and this book is just a kind of an extension of what you do on a daily basis. But why is it so important that we in the Western civilization are not only invested in aid in the Middle East, but in the stories, because what do we learn from these stories that is so important for Christians here in the United States?
I think God put in all of our hearts the ability to connect with a story. You know, I always think of the prophet Nathan when he went to confront David. He didn't say, David, you're an evil, terrible man. What he did is he told him a story. Let me tell you about a guy who stole his neighbor's sheep. And that story connected with David. And then Nathan said, you're the man. You're the guy who did that. We all of us have, and like I say, I think God put it in us when he created us. We connect with stories. And so these stories are designed to inspire us and challenge us. And, you know, I hope that as we read these stories, and I think of some of the stories in this book, I've actually met some of the people in the book, and I hope we read these stories and we say, okay, what would I do? You know, if they came and killed my spouse, what would I do? Would I be able to forgive? Would I be able to say, I forgive you after they killed my spouse? And that, you know, as we put ourselves in the story and we say, okay, what would I do? I think that the natural response to that is introspection and then prayer, that, okay, Lord, I want to be as firm and as faithful and as strong in my faith as these believers are. Help me to do that. Help me to grow deep roots into your word. Help me to be faithful in spite of things maybe not going my way or maybe people responding in a negative way to me. So that's what we really want, is we want people to connect with the stories and we want them to say, okay, I want to have that same kind of faith. And in fact, the book ends with a commitment prayer to be what we call an in Christian. One of those Christians who, sure, you can paint symbols on my house, you can challenge me, you can persecute me, but I'm going to be faithful to Christ no matter what you do. That's the challenge that we want to give people as they read this book, I Am In, is yes, we can be in Christians too. Nobody's probably going to paint a noon on our houses, but we can be bold, faithful followers of Christ in the United States, just like we see in our brothers and sisters who are facing Islamic extremism around the world.
I want to go back to northern Iraq here, and I want you to paint for us a picture of what these communities look like, these caravans, these displaced northern Iraqis. What is the sort of mix there with Christians, non-Christians, Muslims, and the like? Paint a picture for us of what you've seen and what someone who might travel there would see.
Well, let me share the story of one of the Christians that we met, and his name happens to be Muhammad, and I love Christians named Muhammad because that means they weren't always a Christian. Muhammad came to faith in Christ more than 10 years ago, and actually, he was a Sunni Muslim. He lived in the city of Mosul. He had a dream where Jesus came and spoke to him and said, you know, I'm the Son of God. Follow me. Muhammad woke up from his dream, and he said, I'm going to do it. I'm going to follow Jesus Christ. About 6 weeks later, his wife had the exact same dream. And she woke up and said, you're telling me the truth. You're right. We're going to follow Christ together. So they became bold witnesses for Christ in the city of Mosul. This is before ISIS had even been formed. Their house was burned to the ground. So they paid a price for their faith, for their witness. They rebuilt their lives. Then, you know, 2 years ago, ISIS comes, and they had to flee from Mosul. Now, their ID card, which every Iraqi citizen carries, their ID card says Sunni Muslim, because that's what they were before they came to faith. You can't change your religion on your ID card. And so they are living today in a camp of Sunni Muslims. There are more than 1,000 families in this camp. When they got there, they were the only Christian family, surrounded by 1,000 Sunni Muslim families. Now, since then, they have witnessed for Christ and led parts of 2 other families to Jesus. So now there's at least 3 Christian families in this camp in northern Iraq. And they're living in a tent. We went inside their tent. They served tea to us. We're sitting on the floor. There's a kerosene heater. There was snow on the ground outside. There's a kerosene heater in this tent that's kind of knocking the edge off of the cold. I wouldn't say it was warm, but it at least knocked the edge off of it. And we heard Muhammad share his testimony. And, you know, after he shared his testimony, I asked his wife, I said, how is he different since he came to Jesus from what he was before? And she kind of smiled and she said, well, he doesn't beat me anymore. And I was like, well, that's good. That's a good improvement. And then right as we were ending our time together, I asked Muhammad, I said, so what are you praying for? You know, what are you asking God to do for you? And he looked at me kind of like I was from a foreign country, which obviously I was. And he said, you know, we don't have to ask God for anything. We have everything we need. We're happy. And I'm, you know, we're sitting in a tent in a refugee camp surrounded by enemies of the gospel and people who Muhammad says would persecute him if they had the opportunity. And he says, oh, yeah, we have everything we need. We're happy. And I just was like, wow, what an amazing testimony that here is this believer, and he just is satisfied. He just is content to serve the Lord in the surroundings where God has placed him. Even if it's a refugee camp, even if it's in a tent, he's happy and he wants to serve the Lord. And that family actually got the very first family med pack that Voice of the Martyrs delivered. We were there to deliver those. That family got the very first one. And I think I'll always remember that conversation with him and him just saying, hey, you know, we have everything we need. And I thought, what a convicting thing for me, because I don't live in a tent. And still sometimes I think, well, I need this or I need that. I was very convicted by Muhammad's testimony.
It's kind of interesting. You're talking about them as Sunni Christians, so Sunni Muslims that are Christians. So are these camps divided in a way where Christians are all in one camp, Sunnis are all in another camp, and the like?
They are segregated, yes. Now, sometimes it's a separate camp. Sometimes it's a separate area in the camp. But the authorities there have recognized if we just mix everybody together, that's not going to work well. There's going to be trouble. And, you know, Muhammad, even as he shared, he said, you know, we don't leave our kids home alone. We don't leave the tent unattended. We always have somebody that stays here to keep an eye on things, because they know, their neighbors know that they're Christians and they're not happy about it. But they do typically divide it. But as I said, his ID card says Sunni Muslim. So in the eyes of the authorities, he's a Sunni Muslim, and they put him in that camp as opposed to asking him, you know, what are you really? Who do you follow? So that's why he's there. But he considers it an opportunity. Hey, we're here. We're a lighthouse in the middle of this, you know, 1,000 families who are Muslims. We're going to do everything we can to share the gospel while we're here.
You know, it's interesting as a contrast to what we've been seeing in the news lately of the refugees in Germany who are associated with all of these assaults and this big negative disparagement that's being placed upon all those refugees because of those attacks. This is still something that is a very high, intense situation when you have all these people put together in such disparity, correct? These people are not all going to be morally upstanding, and some of them are really just fighting to survive, correct?
That's true, and there is a wide variety of teachings and understandings within these folks, and I don't doubt for a moment that there are some who have very ill intentions, even ISIS plants within these refugee populations, but at the same time, I'm cognizant of how much need there is, and Christ's call, you know, I think about when Christ separates the sheep and the goats and he says, I didn't have a home and you gave me one. Wait a minute, when did we do that, Jesus? Well, when you did it for the least of these. Some of these that are coming out of the Middle East, they are the least of these. They have nothing. They have no hope. Many of them have lost family members. And so there's a great challenge for the West to try to help while at the same time trying to protect ourselves and protect our security from those who would harm us.
Now, recently I was talking with a Coptic Christian who was explaining how there's so much persecution here in the Middle East and we're bringing refugees over to the United States, and yet we're in those countries, particularly Syria, who used to be about 10% Christian, when we're talking about the refugees, we're not seeing those 10% Christians. Where are those Christians and where have they gone? And why aren't we working at least when most are afraid to bring the Muslim refugees over to the United States? Where are the Christian refugees that could be brought over?
Well, that is a great question. And I know there have been some that have come out. You know, we know even from the time the Iraq War started, there have been somewhere in the neighborhood of almost a million Christians that have left Iraq. Many of those have gone into the surrounding countries. Many of them have come to the West. But as you say, there is a challenge if we want to single out Christians and try to help them. There is a challenge to find them and connect them and then get them settled into a third country.
Is it partly because many of them left early when they saw the civil wars breaking out, particularly in Syria, or is it to the fact that they're really just more rooted into the community and they're having an impact? They're spreading the gospel and they see they're staying in the refugee camps. They're not seeking asylum.
There is some of both of that. There's some of all of that. And in fact, you know, one of the pastors we met with, one of his main prayer requests when we asked him, okay, you know, we're going back to the United States, we're going to talk to Christians there, how should we pray? The first prayer request that he told me, he said, pray that God will call Christians to stay here. and he talked about the fact that, you know, he's in this church, God has called him there, they've got an incredible ministry going on, but so many people on his church are leaving. They're leaving Iraq, they don't see a future, and it's hard to argue with him, and it's impossible really to argue with him. It's, humanly speaking, it's a good idea. You know, your children can be safe, they can grow up in safety, they can have a future. But he's saying, pray that God will specifically lay on people's hearts that they need to stay here and continue to serve him. And I thought that was pretty telling that would be his first prayer request. Not, you know, pray that the Lord will protect us or pray that more Muslims will come to Christ. It was pray that God will call Christians to stay here and serve.
Well, let's move on now to what's taking place in Africa. This is an area that we don't cover, and I have to admit, I'm guilty of it as well. We've spent so much time already on the Middle East. We haven't even taken a look at what's taking place in Africa, but there's a lot of very similar, if not even worse, things happening in these African countries, especially with Boko Haram. So why don't you tell us a little bit about what's taking place there?
Well, there are terrible things happening in Africa, and Boko Haram is one. Just in the last couple of weeks, we have seen a suicide bombing at a displaced person camp in northern Nigeria by female suicide bombers. They actually, Boko Haram sent three young women strapped with explosives to pose as displaced persons themselves, get into this camp and blow themselves up. Two of the women did, killing at least 58 people. Another 78 were injured. The third woman, though, and I think this points maybe to a little sliver of hope in this story, the third woman got to the camp and realized that her family was in that camp. Her parents, some of her siblings, they were in that camp, and she decided, no, I'm not going to blow myself up at the camp where my family lives. I'm not going to risk harming my family members. She turned herself into the authorities and told them information about the suicide bombings. In fact, she said, you should expect more of this. So that's one example of what's happening. The new president of Nigeria, when he was elected, he came to power on the strength of, hey, I'm the guy who can handle Boko Haram. I will get this problem under control. That, you know, was over a year ago now, and it seems like things certainly are not under control, and maybe they're worse than they were. That's a concern to Nigeria. It's a concern to Christians. And, you know, like we talked about, so many different faiths being displaced in the Middle East, that's true in northern Nigeria as well. Muslims are affected by this. Christians are affected by this. They are equal opportunity persecutors.
And certainly this is an opportunity where you're seeing churches come together. I know that the reports in the, in previous conversations we've had is that though the churches have been bombed or burnt, really the pastors and the communities are coming together. So you're seeing even a fruit, a response, a good response, even despite the persecution they're facing, correct?
That is so true. And I was in Nigeria in 2013, and one of the interviews I remember clearly from that trip was two pastors. They're from the same village. Their village had come under attack. They had faced persecution. And as you say, it brought them together. And they talked about the fact, you know, before we had persecution, I pretty much did my thing and he did his thing. We had our own churches and we were, you know, we weren't trying to cooperate. It wasn't that we were trying not to cooperate. It just, you know, we had other stuff going on. This persecution has brought us together. And now they are working side by side to work in that community, to fight against the persecution, to support the church in that community. And that's not unique just to that village in Nigeria. That's true all over the world. One of the positive byproducts of persecution is bringing the church together. Frankly, I think that's a part of Voice of the Martyrs ministry here in the United States, is to bring Christians from across denominational lines together and say, hey, we can join hands to pray for our persecuted brothers and sisters. And I'm reminded of the story of Joseph. And at the end of the story, you know, Joseph's brothers are there, and Joseph says, what you intended for evil, God intended for good. And even persecution, even attacks, even church bombings, God is bringing good out of those situations. And one of the good things that he's bringing is a strengthened unity within the body of Christ, a strengthened unity for churches and pastors to work side by side and say, hey, you're a Christian, I'm a Christian, we're brothers and sisters, let's work together, let's share the gospel, let's reach out, let's encourage each other. But that's one of the positive byproducts of persecution.
Now, Voice of the Martyrs does a lot for getting the word out there. They're informing the church, informing the community of believers of how to be praying for and how to be helping those Christians who are suffering around the world. And here, particularly in Africa, there's so much political issues. Does Voice of the Martyr have any involvement in helping mitigate between the legislation as well as the people and the churches who are suffering?
You know, it is not our primary focus, but we do have what we call a special liaison. We have a staff member who goes to Washington, D.C. about five times a year. She meets with congressional staffers and congressmen and senators and tries to educate them about what's happening in places like northern Nigeria, northern Iraq, to help them understand the issues that are involved. You know, in many cases, the American government on the ground in northern Nigeria, the American government is not going to make a huge difference. But at least if we understand the issues that are at play, if we understand who's doing what to whom, we can, you know, where there is opportunities, we can have influence. And so, like I say, that's not the biggest focus for Voice of the Martyrs by any stretch. But we do try to provide that help to our government leaders who want it, to help them understand the persecution of our brothers and sisters. And sometimes they can make a huge difference. You know, a letter from Todd Nettleton maybe doesn't get anybody's attention, but a letter from Senator so-and-so, oh, wait, this is a big deal. This is coming from a senator. We've got to answer this. We've got to figure out what to say. So there is an aspect of VOM's work that is involved in that.
You know, it's interesting because we put a lot of stock in politics, and yet, as we've seen, especially when you look to this next presidential race, there's really not much hope, at least investing in that rat race, so to speak. But there is something to do and to say about prayer and the impact that it has. And I was just praying with a group of pastors this past week about what's taking place in Egypt and all the changes that have been made. The newly elected president in Egypt, who went to a church and apologized, and They've changed their constitution to reflect more freedom for Christians in Egypt. We are seeing change taking place in the African continent, and especially in some of these predominantly Muslim countries like Egypt, correct?
That's true. And, you know, like you say, the thought of a Muslim president of Egypt apologizing to Christians, 10 years ago, I would have said, no, that you're writing a fantasy novel. That will never happen. It is amazing, and we know this, but sometimes we don't act on it. We know that prayer changes people's hearts. We know that God directs the hearts of kings, but sometimes we don't take it seriously enough, our responsibility and our duty to go to the Lord and to pray and to lift up our brothers and sisters. One of the challenges that Jesus laid out for us is even to pray for our enemies. Boy, that's hard. But as we do that, like you say, we see God work, and we see countries, entire countries change through the power of the Holy Spirit.
And give some encouragement to our listeners and maybe some instruction as well as to what to pray for, because so often in our prayers, we're asking for things that that the people in these areas would never ask for. What are the things that we should be praying for when we're thinking about the persecuted church in Africa, in the Middle East, and around the world?
Well, you know, as you say, I think our first thought is to pray, Lord, get them out of that terrible situation.
Yeah.
And that's not their first thought. Mm-hmm. And it's such a challenge to me that they're not saying, Lord, take away the persecution. Lord, take away our suffering. What they're asking us to pray for is pray that they'll be faithful to Christ in spite of the persecution. And so when I talk to people about how to pray, I think that's it. Pray that they'll be faithful. And, you know, this book I am in that we're releasing, and the themes sort of provide a roadmap for our prayer. You know, we talk about sacrifice, pray for those who are sacrificing, pray that God will encourage them and that they will understand that the sacrifice they're making is small in comparison to the love of Christ and in comparison to eternity. Courage, joy, perseverance, forgiveness, faithfulness, those are things we can pray for our brothers and sisters, that they'll be able to exhibit those qualities, that God will sustain them and encourage them. One of the things I often pray is that the Lord will supernaturally let them know that they're being prayed for. You know, I think of Gracia Burnham, who was a hostage in the Philippines, and as she shares her story, she says there were times when they were in the jungle and her or Martin would look at each other and they'd say, somebody's praying for us right now. And what an encouragement and what a blessing that was. And so that's one of my prayers is, Lord, let this person know right now in that jail cell, right now as they're being persecuted, let them know somehow supernaturally through your Holy Spirit, let them know somebody's praying for me right at this moment, and let that be an encouragement to them. And then I think always I want to encourage people, remember to pray for the persecutors. You know, as we talk about the move of God's Spirit in the Middle East, we've had stories in the last year of ISIS fighters coming to know Jesus Christ in a personal way. These folks are not beyond the reach of God's grace, and so we always want to pray for the persecutors to come to know Christ in a personal way, to follow him, and to have their hearts changed. We know, you know, Saul was a persecutor. He went to Damascus to hunt down Christians and bring them to what he would call justice. He ran into Jesus Christ and became Paul, the apostle, the great missionary. We pray for many more Sauls to have that encounter with Jesus Christ and to become Pauls who will share the gospel in ways and places that you and I could never go or never do.
Well, great, great encouragement, especially when we think about prayer. Let's move on to talk about China now. Here is a country that's made a lot of advances, a lot of opportunities for the gospel to be even less restricted, and yet some recent events have shown that they're still in a tug of war over how to control, especially religion, in the country of China. So tell us a little bit about what's taking place in that part of the world.
Well, we have seen over the last 18 months, literally over 1,000 churches being affected by persecution in China. the Chinese government is coming in, they're demolishing church buildings, they're taking the cross down off of church buildings. And I love it that as you ask this question, you use that word control, because that's the bottom line for the Chinese government. You can be a Christian, that's fine, as long as you're a communist first. As long as your first loyalty is to the communist government, then if your second loyalty or your third loyalty is to Jesus, that's okay with us. We don't mind that. But if your first loyalty is to Jesus Christ, wait a minute, we have a problem now. And one of the things that is changing, and it's a very significant change, is we're seeing registered church pastors being arrested and persecuted. These are pastors within the state-sanctioned Three Self Patriotic Movement. They're now being taken to jail if they speak out about the government persecution of the church. And, you know, the Chinese government story has always been, well, you know, sure, there are some house churches that we arrest people, but it's all about, you know, they won't register. They won't do what's legal. But if they would just register, then there wouldn't be any persecution. Then we'd all get along fine. Well, the lie of that is being illustrated as these registered church pastors are now facing arrest and persecution. But we hear some amazing stories. One of the pastors who was arrested spent a year in jail. He talked about how he had direct contact with 180 prisoners while he was in prison. He was able to share the gospel. 100 of those prisoners came to Christ. So he had contact with 180. He led 100 to Christ. Another 50 were interested. They wanted to hear more. They, you know, they said, I'm going to follow you on Twitter, or maybe I'll visit your church sometime after I'm released. He said only 30 of the prisoners were actually opposed to the gospel and basically said, you know, shut up, I don't want to hear that. So this pastor came out of 12 months in jail, and instead of being discouraged, he was excited. He said, you know, if I had been pastoring my church the last 12 months, I wouldn't have led 100 people to Christ. But here I was in jail, and I got to do that. Isn't that amazing? Isn't God good? So even in the midst of persecution, there are good news stories, and God is at work. But the persecution, the leveling of church buildings, and the tearing down of crosses was centered in one province of China. We have now heard that the national government has told all the other provinces, hey, look at the good work they're doing. You need to do that too. So we are expecting in the coming year that persecution is going to spread throughout the nation of China, because now it's the national government that's pushing it as opposed to a provincial government.
I have a lot of friends who are in China who are American citizens that when they go to church, they have to show a passport. They go to an international church. And we're talking about the state-allowed churches, the registered churches versus the non-registered churches. You have a real, I think Americans have a hard time wrapping their mind around that, because we have separation of church and state. So maybe you can explain just a little bit more of just how much control there really is in China to legislate their spirituality, their faith.
Well, you know, as you say, that bottom line issue is control. And in the registered church, the Chinese government, through their religious, what used to be called the Religious Affairs Bureau, I think it's now the State Administration for Religious Affairs, they determine who can preach in those state-sanctioned meetings, where those meetings can happen, and what time they can happen. And it is basically a Christianity within the four walls of the church. You come on Sunday, you spend a couple hours together, you sing your songs, you preach your sermon, and then you go home and be a good communist for the next 6 days, and then come back next Sunday. If you do that, then the government doesn't have a problem with you. If you are witnessing, if you're out, you know, giving Bibles to people, if you're out sharing the gospel with people, that suddenly is a threat. And so the house church says, or the unregistered church says, you know, the Communist Party is not the head of the church. Jesus Christ is the head of the church. The registered church tries to work within that structure. And one of the challenges, and I remember the first time I visited China back in 1999, we were told the story of a registered church pastor who was a very effective, very evangelical in his outreach, sharing the gospel, growing his church. And he was reassigned from his large church in a major city to a church of about a dozen people out in a village somewhere because he was getting outside the bounds of what they wanted him to do. That's the level of control that the government wants to exert. And the unregistered church says, no, we're not going to come under that kind of control. We're going to follow Jesus. We're going to do what he asked us to do. And, you know, those pastors who try to work within the registered system, if they get too far out of bounds, and even these now that are in jail because they're protesting against this persecution, I think we're seeing a little bit of a crack in that picture of, oh, yeah, everyone's fine. They just registered with the government. That issue of control is the bottom line.
What seems interesting is that you would think that in a place like China, you would have more free reign for Voice of the Martyrs is concerned to go in there and to work and to help. And yet you have more access to northern Iraq than you do to China because they're registered and because of the government involvement versus a communist versus a Muslim country. You have more of a reign, I'm assuming, in Iraq and Syria than you do in China, correct?
Different kind of access. We certainly have access in China too. We have staff that are going there, visiting with pastors and Christians. Definitely a little more, I would say, low key. For instance, it wouldn't be common necessarily, but it wouldn't be a problem at a church meeting in northern Iraq if an American was asked to bring a greeting. You know, hey, stand up and share your testimony or share a greeting with the people. I don't think anybody would think twice about that in northern Iraq. At a church in China, that would be somewhat of an issue because that issue of foreigners coming in and speaking in a church, that's a little more dangerous, a little more sensitive. So there are definitely differences, and northern Iraq is, right now at least, is very accessible. The Kurdish people love Americans and have made it clear that Americans are welcome in their territory. So there's differences, but we're able to get in and we're able to meet with Christians and encourage them in both places. We just have to understand kind of the condition on the ground and be sensitive to the different restrictions and needs.
Well, we tell our listeners all the time, it's great to get all this information because it also informs our prayer life and it encourages our faith to find out more about what's happening around the world with our fellow brothers and sisters in Christ. And we always inform them of your website, persecution.org, and of course, your magazine that they can sign up and register to for free. But you also have a podcast. I don't think we've ever talked about that before. Why don't you tell us a little bit more about your podcast and how you're getting the word out over the air?
We do. I want to correct you on one thing. Our website is persecution.com. So okay. Persecution.com. We do have a podcast. We call it VOM Radio, and you can search for it on iTunes. You can find it at vomradio.net. But I want to encourage people to listen. One of our recent episodes, we talked with Dale Rotun, and Dale, along with George Verwer, was one of the founders of Operation Mobilization. So he's got some amazing stories of just his missionary work and different places he's been. But one of the stories that we shared on the podcast is right after Richard Wurmbrand, who was the founder of Voice of the Martyrs, right after Richard was released from prison in Romania, Dale was part of an Operation Mobilization team that was traveling through Bucharest, and they made arrangements to go and meet with Richard and Sabina. And when they asked about it, the Christians were like, you know, he just got out of prison. The police are probably watching him. That might not be a good idea. You maybe shouldn't do that. And Dale and his team said, okay, you know, that's fine, but will you at least ask Richard if he would like to see us or if it would be okay? And Richard was like, hey, come on, that'll be great. And Dale shares in the podcast at vomradio.net, he shares about being in this apartment, and he's looking around the room. There's about 10 people there, and he's trying to pick out, okay, who's the guy who was just in prison? Who's the guy who spent, you know, 14 of the last 16 years in prison? And he couldn't figure it out. He couldn't look at the faces and see, okay, you know, that guy's really depressed. It must be him. And so he leaned over to the guy next to him and he said, so, you know, which one is the guy who was in prison? And he pointed to Richard, and Dale says that Richard just glowed. He had a smile on his face. He looked excited. He was talking about things he wanted to do for the Lord, places he wanted to preach. And he looked at the guy next to him. He's like, are you sure? I mean, because that does not look like a guy who's been in prison. And the guy next to him said, yeah, I'm sure. That's my father. And it was Michael Wormbrand, Richard's son, who was sitting next to him in the room. And so we talk a little bit in the podcast about what is it that allows a man to be in prison for 14 years and come out with a glow and an excitement and a love for the Lord that is so evident that it would never dawn on you that's a guy who's just been in prison. He just looks so content and so excited. So I encourage people, again, vormradio.net, go listen to that interview. It's pretty inspiring to hear from someone who was with Richard, like I say, literally probably just a few weeks or months after he came out of prison, to testify about how he responded to that experience.
Well, we've been talking with Todd Nettleton. He's the director and Voice of the Martyrs, and I'm going to let you give them your information again because I don't want to mess up your website. tell them where they can listen not only to the podcast, but where they can sign up for your newsletter.
Well, the podcast is at vomradio.net. We also have a link there on our main website, which is persecution.com. Persecution.com. You can sign up for our free monthly newsletter. You can actually request a free copy of Richard Wormbrand's book, Tortured for Christ. We'd be happy to send you that. So persecution.com. We'd love to hear from you. And like I say, that free monthly newsletter serves as kind of a prayer guide the whole year long to help you pray effectively for our brothers and sisters around the world.
And I want them to be aware of your book as well, The IMN. That'll be coming out in April, and they can pre-order it as well. Again, we've been talking with Todd Nettleton from Voice of the Martyrs. Todd, thank you so much for keeping us informed of what is taking place with the persecuted church around the world.
You're so welcome, and thank you for having me. And I want to thank the listeners for their prayers for our persecuted family.
We hope you enjoyed this interview made possible by our ministry at Songtime Radio. You can find out more information about our ministry by visiting our website at songtime.com, where you can find this and other interviews on our podcast series, as well as our weekday broadcast, which includes teaching, interviews, and music. We also want to encourage you to sign up for our free monthly newsletter. It's got encouraging articles, and there is no obligation. To find out more information about our ministry, again, visit our website at songtime.com. This ministry is made possible by people just like yourself. We are 100% supported by our listeners. So if you have been blessed today, why not join with the many voices together for that one message, the gospel of Jesus Christ, with your donation to the Songtime Ministry. To make a donation, you can do so online at our website at songtime.com, as well as by mail. Write to us at Songtime Radio, P.O. Box 100, Barnstable, Massachusetts, 02630, or give us a call. Make a donation over the phone. It's 508-362-7070. On behalf of our entire Songtime staff and our own Dr. John DeBrine, the founder here at Songtime, who encourages you to grow in grace and not groan in disgrace, from Cape Cod, I'm Adam Miller. God bless.